The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
So we started with Google autocomplete. Type "I think I am" into Google, and Google will inform you that you may think you are pregnant, you may think you are bipolar, you may think you're depressed, you may think you're gay, you may think you're crazy. I'm scared that. What do you think Google thinks you're scared at? You're scared that you're gay, you're scared that you might have HIV, you might have herpes, you might be pregnant. Like, we use Google as a kind of collective diary of whatever we may be thinking, whatever maybe we may be experiencing. The first thing we're doing is confiding it to this remote entity. And I think it's an interesting thing that, you know, large numbers of people, when they think they might have HIV, the first thing they're going to do is to give that information to Google, which is the last thing you would do if you were greatly concerned about your privacy with respect to Google. I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, June 26, 2015. A few weeks ago, Jody Liu and I released a Brookings paper entitled The Privacy Paradox, which looked at the flip sides of some technologies people generally assume will threaten privacy. This past week, I was asked to speak on the paper at George Mason Law and Economics Center's third annual public policy conference on privacy and data security. It's an, I hope, amusing and, I hope, provocative attempt to stir up the privacy debate a little, given before an audience of mostly state regulatory and attorney general staffers. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 129, Porn, Condoms, Pregnant Teens, and the Privacy Benefits of Privacy Threats.
I hope we'll sort of lighten this up a little bit. I've never spoken about this paper before in public, which is partly because the subject of the paper is almost wall-to-wall embarrassing to discuss. So I'm not going to talk about the future of violence, and I'm not going to talk about, you know, Constitution 3.0 and freedom and technological change. We're going to talk about pornography is really what this is going to be about. And I want to start by asking those of you who have seen the movie Bananas, which is a late 60s or early 70s era Woody Allen movie, to remember the scene in which the Woody Allen character goes to a newsstand to buy pornography. And the scene is a scene of absolutely cringing embarrassment, which is what makes it funny, in which he is trying to find, you know, A, identify the magazine that he wants to buy, but B, hide it beneath, you know, more high-minded materials. And so he narrates out loud that he's going to buy Newsweek and National Review and Time, and I will just slip this in. And it all works out very badly for him because there's no price on the porn that he wants to buy. And the result is that the cashier shouts across the room that he wants to buy a copy. And I saw this recently, again, for the, you know, 30,000th time in my life, and realized that there is an entire generation that has grown up without this experience. And this is, I mean, you know, I think, like, any male who would stand up here and say, you know, above a certain age, who would stand up there and say that they have had no experience remotely like this, is lying. And, but below a certain age, this is actually a scene that is bewildering now because of a set of technologies that we commonly think of as privacy threats. And so I thought, you know, isn't that interesting that this set of privacy threats has delivered us from the cringing, a scene of such universal embarrassment that it makes a Woody Allen movie. So that's the subject of the paper that I'm going to talk about, is the privacy benefits of privacy threats, which turns out to be a very rich subject. And I want to start out by saying that I'm not an economist, and I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not a privacy activist. I think that if there's one general observation I'd like you to take away from this, it's that our contemporary debate about privacy keeps score really badly. And the general pattern is when we're confronted by a new technology that has privacy benefits and privacy risks both at the same time, as a society, we pocket all the benefits cheerfully without noticing that we've done it, and we complain bitterly about the costs. And the result is that we have a whole series of technologies that we only talk about the costs in privacy terms of and ignore the privacy benefits entirely. And so what we tried to do in this paper was, in a very kind of cursory and I hope amusing way, actually, to go through some of the privacy benefits and readjust the scorecard a little bit. I want to emphasize what the thesis is not. The thesis is not that everything you think is bad for your privacy is really good for your privacy. The thesis is not that new technologies are delivering a golden age of privacy. The thesis is rather that the scorecard is actually complicated and that it may differ greatly technology to technology and individual to individual. All right, so let's start with the traditional view, right? The traditional view is that, and this is, I think, so universally accepted that we really don't argue about it. We actually had a very difficult time identifying any dissenting literature on this point. The traditional view is that privacy is constantly eroding. New technologies take it away, and we trade the convenience and benefits of those new technologies for the inevitable erosion that they produce. So you get lots of benefits by being able to search things on Google, by being able to buy your books on Amazon, but you pay for it in privacy terms, right? CVS gives you a card, you go to CVS, you get a little discount, but they're buying your privacy in response to it. The conventional narrative has this as almost an inevitable feature of technological advance, particularly technological advance that involves data collection. So I want to revise this in a number of ways. First of all, I'm not saying any of it's wrong. I think all of the privacy costs that people have identified, many of them are real, right? And when you do things online, you do risk that some remote entity knows stuff about you. You're giving information. And that information can come back and bite you in the butt. And it does. It does in the sense that companies turn around and market things to you in ways that may be offensive to you. It may be upsetting. It does in the sense that the government may come along and subpoena that information if you get wrapped up in, even tangentially, in a criminal investigation or a regulatory investigation. It also does in the more limited sense, or sort of the more unpredictable sense, that companies have not always been the greatest at protecting the data that they collect, and data breaches produce all kinds of weird adverse privacy consequences for the individuals in question. So I'm not questioning the truth of the basic narrative as far as it goes, but there are some big pieces of it that are missing. So the first point I want to make is that privacy is not an abstract value. It's a very applied value. And if you are a pregnant teenager, you may not care what Google knows about what's going on with you, but you may care a lot about whether your parents know about what's going on around you. And so for that person in that situation, the privacy calculation could be entirely different from the person who reasonably expects that her material is likely to be hacked because she's a celebrity, right? Those are very, very different situations. And the question that you should always ask when somebody's talking about privacy is privacy from whom? What I want to submit as a preliminary matter is that privacy from whom, it's possible that very, very large numbers of people do not answer that question the same way that privacy scholars and activists would answer it on their behalf. Hold that thought for a minute. Second observation is that privacy can be a two-way street, and it's possible for a technology to add to your privacy in some ways while taking it away in other ways. Let me give you an example of that. If you ask a privacy activist, the worst way in the world to read a book is on a Kindle, right? Amazon knows not only what books you've read, but what pages you're on, what page you've read, what passages you particularly liked. And all that stuff gets stored in a database, right? This is the worst possible way to read. The last statistics I showed that 50 Shades of Grey was outselling on Kindle by 6 times what it was selling in hardcover or paperback. What's the reason for that? Because people actually don't mind if Amazon has that information. They really don't want to be seen on the subway reading 50 Shades of Grey. Privacy from whom matters, and large numbers of people may feel very differently about it from the way, from the intuitions of what's important to privacy advocates and scholars. I want to distinguish between immediate privacy and remote privacy. This is something that people don't talk about enough, and they should. Many people's most immediate privacy concerns are the people immediately around them. And this can operate at a very irrational level. They don't want the people around them to know what they're up to. People don't want to look somebody in the eye at a CVS when they buy condoms and say, "I'm having sex tonight, how much do I owe you?" Right? That's a transaction people don't enjoy. Now, they do, on the other hand, care much less than people think on their behalf what remote entities that store data know about them. Just an observation. Finally, I want to suggest that there's no right answer to those questions. There's only individual preference. If you're somebody who really is inhibited in your individual interactions by what the person in front of you will think, what you want to or don't want to communicate to them, your privacy equation is going to be very different from if you're somebody like me who's perfectly willing to stand up in front of a group of people and talk about pornography, but has had some security issues. My website has been subject to various denial of service attacks. So I do kind of think about the privacy of remote entities in ways that, you know, other people may not actually have rational reason to do. All right, so let's apply this. We did 3 case studies in this. And I want to start, we were looking for data sets that would suggest whether actually people are really looking, really behaving in a fashion that suggests that their own privacy is not quite the privacy that activists would have it be. So we started with Google autocomplete. So Google, if you start typing words into Google, Google will finish things for you. It's very helpful. It prevents misspellings. It shortens the amount of time you have to take. You suddenly find that you actually want to search something different than you thought you did. And of course, the way it works is it is aggregating large amounts of data of what other people have searched, which makes it a really interesting window into what people are searching for on Google. It's one of the relatively few windows we have because Google doesn't give out that sort of data. All right, so I don't think anybody has a computer open. But if you type symptoms into Google, it'll give you a bunch of options, right? It'll symptoms of strep, symptoms of high blood pressure, and symptoms of HIV. Now, HIV is a much less common condition than blood pressure, high blood pressure and strep. And I think it's an interesting thing that, you know, large numbers of people, when they think they might have HIV, the first thing they're going to do is to give that information to Google, which is the last thing you would do if you were greatly concerned about your privacy with respect to Google. Type "I think I am" into Google, and Google will inform you that you may think you are pregnant, you may think you are bipolar, you may think you're depressed, you may think you're gay, you may think you're crazy. So again, you're starting to see, like, we use Google as a kind of collective diary of whatever we may be thinking, whatever maybe we may be experiencing. The first thing we're doing is confiding it to this remote entity. I'm scared that. What do you think Google thinks you're scared at? You're scared that you're gay. You're scared that you might have HIV. You might have herpes. You might be pregnant. I'm confused about my gender. Large numbers of people are telling Google that they're confused about their gender. Large numbers of people are also telling Google that they're confused about their religion and their sexuality. People are telling Google that they're unsure about whether to have an abortion. And if you type "was I" into Google, you'll find that large numbers of people are also asking Google, were they molested or sexually assaulted? And if you type "how to know," people want to know how to know if they were roofied, drugged, abused as a child, or sexually abused. So I think none of this is consistent with the idea that this very large group of people, large enough to produce autocomplete outcomes, is fundamentally more concerned about their privacy from the remote entity than they are from the people around them. If you're confused about your religion in a, say, insular community that doesn't really want people to have a lot of confusion about what it's teaching, Google's probably a privacy godsend for you. If you think you may have been roofied and you don't want to talk to the people around you about it yet, this is a really good privacy option, right? And we never talk about it that way. We never talk about the privacy. We only focus on the privacy consequences of the potential privacy consequences of the use, not the immediate privacy gain that the person maybe in a crisis situation may be experiencing. All right, so let's talk about retail. So a lot of the same things that I just said about Google search are also true of retail. You know, I have a friend who, when I presented this paper to him, this is a very thoughtful scholar and by no means a Nazi, said to me, you know, this is a distinguished professor at a university. And he said, you know, recently I had occasion to read Mein Kampf. And I was really interested that after I had ordered it, I started getting these completely non-judgmental notices from Amazon when I would log in. Customers who enjoyed Mein Kampf also enjoyed The Eternal Jew by Henry Ford, you know. And And he was amused by it because it was presented in this completely non-judgmental, you know. And I thought, well, there's a privacy benefit right there. I mean, now the privacy of Nazis is maybe a matter of not the greatest social concern, certainly not to me. On the other hand, put yourself in the shoes of the person who is questioning their sexual identity as a teenager. And the ability to get that information presented in a completely non-judgmental way. People who, you know, who enjoyed our bodies ourselves also enjoyed, right? I mean, that is not without privacy benefit. Now, it goes a step further than that, because we're not just talking about Amazon. People have all kinds of, you might say, irrational, but they're no less heartfelt for being irrational, inhibitions about purchasing things. I mentioned the 17-year-old boy who wouldn't want to face somebody in a CVS and buy condoms. Turns out there are whole markets online available to serve exactly such people. So there are many, many condom distributors that are online only, and when you buy from them, they show up on your credit card with a disguised name, you know, ABC Retailers or something. And they send you things in a brown paper wrapper with somebody else's name on the cover. And we asked them. We asked the spokesman for the very reputable rubber club. You can't make this stuff up. Like, why do you do this? You can buy condoms from, you know, from Walmart online, from Amazon. You can buy condoms. There's 1,000 places to buy condoms online. Why a specialty condom dealership online? And the answer was, quote, that the entire impetus is, quote, to enable individuals to practice safe sex more privately. Now, think about that for a minute, because this is not the most private way. If Mark Rotenberg were up here, or a privacy activist, he would say, wait a minute, that's a crazy thing to do. It creates a record with your name on it. It creates a time and date stamp. You're much better off going into your local CVS paying cash, right? And yet that is not what feels more private to people. The human lived experience of privacy is not served by that behavior. Okay, so I went to CVS and I approached them and I asked them to give me data about what happened to condom sales when they installed auto checkout machines. Now, I think you don't need to hear the answer to know what it's going to be, right? So they wouldn't give me the data, is the answer. But I think the no pun intended, pregnant pause there suggests that we all know that if you install auto checkout machines in CVS, the number of condoms that are sold there, particularly among to teenagers, is going to go way up. And I'll prove that to you using the last case study I did, which I talked about, which is the Google auto checkout stuff. If you type self-checkout into Google, it will say condoms, right? Because there are actually a lot of people who don't want to buy condoms in front of a person. So we couldn't get data from this from Target, from Google, from CVS, or from Walmart. But there was a really interesting study on a related issue done by two librarians in Illinois that I think is actually, you know, jokes aside, a very serious and interesting piece of work. There was an auto checkout machine installed in their college library, and they decided to study what the prevalence of LGBT materials checked out through the auto checkout machine versus through the regular line was. And the answer, as you would expect, is it's a beautifully conducted study, actually. They did controls for how close the books were to the different lines. So it's a very elegantly done study, and they showed a very substantial increase for the simple reason that people actually are inhibited by facing another person. I would suggest this is a very substantial privacy gain, albeit one that may seem pretty trivial. Which brings us to the ultimate triviality, pornography. So porn is a really interesting area to study in this space, quite apart from the great jokes that you get to tell. It's an area that, first of all, we consume a very large amount of as a society. And secondly, people really don't like to talk about their consumption habits, right? And so you have a very rich amount of consumption. And fortunately, we have these companies that track people's porn consumption. And some of them are good enough to publish it. So I want to talk about one of my favorite CD companies. It's called Pornhub. And Pornhub is one of the larger porn distributors on the internet. And conveniently, they publish a lot of aggregate data about porn consumption. Some of it is just amusing stuff, you know, what days of the year does porn usage strike a spike, hint, Christmas, you know, holidays. But some of it is actually really more substantial than that. And they often mask it in a sort of jovial language. But I actually think some of the data is really interesting. So I'm just going to mention one particular fact, which is that in the Pornhub data, the states that have the highest consumption by a lot of gay pornography are Deep South states, which have among the lowest open LGBT communities. And again, I think that gives you a sense of people's relative in the sort of lived experience of privacy, the disparity between the way people feel about the people around them and the way people feel about remote entities that collect data. How aggressive are these companies about collecting data? Okay, so one of the companies that we write about has this thing called Porn IQ, which is basically like Pandora. You know, you give it a whole lot of information about yourself and your consumption habits, and it routes the right porn to you. And this is, so you think about, like, what would people be terrified of, right? What people who are privacy conscious should be terrified of? I would think Porn IQ would be sort of right up there with the scariest stuff. And that's not apparently the way a large number of people, I'm sure some people react to it that way, but it's a viable enough product that it's available. So I'm going to stop there, and I think I've thrown a lot of spaghetti at the wall, and see if anything sticks, and whatever you guys want to talk about. Sir.
So do you think this also has an implications for criminal activity online? So I might not want to mug some little old lady in the street, but if I can steal her bank account, it's not that big a deal because I never have to see her.
That's a very interesting question. And that's actually a question that we treat in The Future of Violence, which is sort of a different corner of my life. I think it's a very interesting question whether remoteness from people does create a sort of lessened inhibition about nasty activity with respect to them. And I certainly think there are a group of people who would never pick someone's pocket in real life but have no problem, you know, picking their pockets online. I think that's probably right. scared off by porn?
Okay, on the porn stuff.
There we go.
I'm curious, have you had an opportunity to differentiate between free porn sites and porn sites that actually are pay-per-use, where there's actually identifiable information versus pseudonym, made-up email account kind of registrations, to see if there's differences in habits or differences in the kind of material delivered, that kind?
So I haven't, and I think it's a potentially very fruitful area. We were going off of what was available publicly right now. But I do think, all jokes aside, I do think pornography is a very interesting area to study from a privacy point of view, just because the data sets are very big. The consumption is, I won't say universal, but let's say very widespread. And the preference for consuming it privately, as opposed to in outward-facing settings, is overwhelming. And so I think it gives a very I don't know what that says about us as a society, Ben, and like Amazon with Mein Kampf, I'm going to be just report it non-judgmentally, but I think it does create a very interesting set of opportunities to look at the way people experience privacy in their day-to-day lived lives, rather than as a sort of esoteric exercise in defining what we think the answers to questions should be. That said, I have not seen a lot of good data on it, and much of the data that is out there is, like Pornhub Insights, sort of published almost as a fun joke kind of thing. And I think it would really benefit from some sustained cooperation between some of the big providers, as distasteful as they may be as enterprises, and some academic institutions. Sir.
So you don't come out and say it, but I gather that, sort of reading between the lines, you describe it as, the way people live out their privacy. Face-to-face privacy to you seems to be maybe the gold standard of what privacy is. I could be wrong in ascribing that to you, but it seems that you suggest that that's maybe more important, or certainly people value that, at least certain types of people value that more than the other one. So
I would actually, just not to interrupt you, but I would actually say that a little bit differently. What I would say is that I think our public debate undervalues face-to-face privacy relative to the way people actually behave. And if you study the way people actually behave, they put a higher value on what goes on face-to-face than the privacy debate does on their behalf.
Okay. But then you give the examples of the north-south divide and sort of certain porn habits. That suggests maybe that certain cultures value it or overvalue it or undervalue it more, and other cultures have place different types of emphases on different types of privacy. So my question really is sort of where policymakers put the thumb on the scale, does that tell us which culture they're sort of privileging?
It may. I mean, I'm not sure that that example, I'm not sure I read that example the same way that you do. The way I read that example is if you're in a community that's, potentially very hostile to coming out, you may be much less likely to show your face at the local gay bar, and much more likely to consume pornography furtively in your own room. So I do think that there's a sort of local social culture aspect of that. But yes, But broadly, I think the answer to that question is yes. I think often we use the word privacy as a sort of catchword for a general sense of not wanting other people to know what we're up to. But we're very in particular about defining what the specific set of values that we're trying to protect people from. And we don't actually do the work to say, okay, my concern on behalf of this person is X, and that that person, and we really don't go verify with that person that our concern on that person's behalf is consonant with that person's concern on her own behalf. And I think that's just lazy, frankly, and we ought to have a we ought to do that work of understanding what people gain and lose in the terms of privacy that matter to them from the technologies that we're A, bringing to market, B, regulating, C, worrying about. Yes, ma'am. Oh, I meant you, but you can go in either direction.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, when you're considering the value that consumers may be placing on anonymity when they go to do a Google search or they're viewing pornography online or, you know, whatever example you want to use, are you also considering, you know, whether those consumers are, whether they fully understand the potential risks or the potential ways that their information could be used? I mean, I kind of wonder if consumers did fully understand that, would that have some kind of a chilling effect on their online behavior?
So again, it's a very fair question, and I certainly would not argue that the conventional privacy worry is wrongheaded in that regard. I think both the possibility of subsequent misuse, both people's lack of understanding of what happens to data once it's put out there, those are all entirely legitimate concerns. My only interest is in suggesting that those are not the only factors in the equation, and that the individual's engagement, the individual might have much more immediate privacy concerns that, for example, the Google search helps alleviate, as well as, you know, as I say, totally irrational concerns about that just amount to inhibitions against interactions with people over certain issues. Do I think people would behave differently if they understood how material is being used? I suspect not, because I suspect our immediate interests in the things that we get, both privacy benefits and non-privacy benefits and convenience benefits and other benefits that we get from the use of these technologies, has an impulse control reduction factor, but that's just a guess on my part, and I really don't know the answer to it.
So I think some of the comments are I'm going to be repeating them, but hopefully add something new. That your idea of the lived experience of privacy is the very reason why the conversation around privacy is the way it is right now. That the lived experience of privacy when you go to buy a porn magazine is the self-regulator, right? That a business that sells magazines is going to be very careful about not advertising that I just bought a porn magazine, because they'll lose my business, right? So they're going to be pretty careful with that information. But that, so privacy advocates don't have to help me in that regard. But that when I go purchase something on the internet, either I'm not aware or I am aware, and it's less personal to me in that moment because it's less immediate. I need that conversation around privacy, and I need those privacy advocates to help me in that regard, right? That my interfacing embarrassment is no longer the self-regulator, and so that's why the conversation is the way it is.
So I think there's a lot of truth in that. But I also think that the result of that, and in some ways the Woody Allen bananas example is the example that most brings out your point. He has a very good option there, which is, you know, to be inhibited. And the store clerk has a very good option, which is not to shout his purchase habits across the room, which would probably be better for business. I think the pregnant teenager and the clinic that she ends up going to has fewer good options in a world that doesn't have, you know, search that doesn't have, and the, in some ways, the most poignant examples to me are the kids, and a lot of them are kids, who find communities of people who are questioning one facet or another of their identities, religious dissenters, you know, people who are, you know, LGBT of one sort or another, as well as, you know, other groups of people. Now, if you look on Facebook, Facebook will routinely describe the groups that come together with varying degrees of privacy associated with it. They routinely describe these as community benefits, people finding communities of interest. You know, if you're finding a community that excludes the people you want to exclude, that's also an immense privacy benefit. And we never talk about it that way. So again, I don't dispute your point at all. And I would just ask to pull a little bit away from the frivolous example. Look, if the end result of this stuff was easier, more private access to porn, it's a fun way to talk about it, but it's not actually what I'm, it's a window into it, but it's not actually what I'm really talking about. And I do think that there's really a, there are some very weighty concerns that, you know, push on the other side of that privacy ledger, and we tend to dismiss them as convenience. And my point is they're actually a little bit more than convenience. Yes.
Any implications from your speech you would draw for policies? So you have a number of, you know, government or state officials in the room. Where do we go, if anywhere?
Well, so I, number one, I would say there is a reflex, a policy reflex, whenever we see a new technology. That is, we say, hey, look, it lets us do X, and X is really cool. And on the other hand, somebody is collecting data, and we say, the cost of X is lessened privacy in the following respect. And the first policy implication I would say is do that calculation accurately. Don't stop with, yes, there are the following privacy implications, which there, there will be, I don't doubt. Ask yourself also what the potential, what the real privacy equation looks like. Are there privacy benefits that users are getting from this? And when you think about the aggregate privacy impact, don't simply tabulate the costs, but also tabulate the potential gains. As in, do a more rigorous privacy impact analysis. And I think if you look at, I think that that process will be very disciplining at a lot of levels of policy. The second thing is understand that there is many more than one type of privacy at issue, and that, you know, a world in which nobody has to see you read 50 Shades of Grey, but Amazon knows what which passages you read 8 times, right? That is not simply a worse privacy environment than the one where you walk into the subway and everybody sees you reading 50 Shades of Grey, or maybe that you don't read 50 Shades of Grey because you're afraid of that. It's a different privacy environment. It's one in which is better for some people, worse for others. And I think we need to embrace at a policy level the complexity of some of the impacts, which are diverse and will differ from person to person. And I don't know, that's actually work I haven't done at a policy level, is, you know, what if you have a technology that is much better for most people's privacy but awful for some people's? You know, the aggregate impact will be lots of people have the ability to do X privately, which they couldn't do before. But every now and then, WikiLeaks will come around and steal a whole lot of information and release it, and the result is to expose, you know, everybody's X habits. So there were examples of that, by the way, with Amazon, where one of the Sony employees had a large amount of Amazon purchases, mostly of beauty products. And they were completely anodyne. And they weren't the sort of things that you would say I'd be sensitive about buying them. But it turns out if WikiLeaks publishes all the emails from Sony, including all yours, including all your Amazon emails, and then Jezebel comes along and finds all your Amazon purchases of all your beauty products, and then writes a mocking piece about you and your beauty product purchases, that's a pretty nasty privacy impact, you know? And so it's perfectly possible that Amazon purchasing can be great for the guy who's studying Mein Kampf and, you know, get some good book recommendations in a sort of non... But, you know, if you're the person who, you know, the whiplash hits hard, it can be awful for you. So my basic non-answer to your question is just embrace the fact that these impacts are going to be very complicated. Thank you very much. The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to the folks at the George Mason Law and Economics Center for giving us access to the audio of this event. Please help spread the word about the Lawfare podcast. Tweet it, share it, and for the love of God, rate and review it on whatever podcast distribution system you use. Our music is, as always, performed by the incomparable Sophia Yan. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.